te vasudevaya. So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, it's canto 10, chapter 47, which is entitled The Song of the Bee. And we're reading text number 11 today. Kachin madu karam drishpa.
Kachin madu karam drishpa.
Dhyayanti Krishna Sangamam.
Dhyayanti Krishna Sangamam.
Priya prasta patam dutam.
Priya prasta patam dutam.
Kalpayit vedam agavit.
Kalpayit vedam agavit.
Kachin madu karam drishpa.
Kachin madu karam drishpa.
Dhyayanti Krishna Sangamam.
Dhyayanti Krishna Sangamam.
Priya prasta patam dutam.
Priya prasta patam dutam.
Kalpayit vedam abravit.
Kalpayit vedam abravit.
Kachin madu karam risva.
Kachin madu karam risva.
Dhyayanti Krishna Sangamam.
Dhyayanti Krishna Sangamam.
Priya prasta patam dutam.
Priya prastapitam dutam.
Kalpayit vedam abravit.
Kalpayit vedam abravit.
Kachit.
Kachit.
One
of the gopis.
Mulukaram.
Mulukaram.
A bumblebee.
Bumblebee.
Drishva.
Drishva.
Seeing.
Seeing.
Dhyayanti.
Dhyayanti.
While meditating. Krishna Sangamam.
Krishna Sangamam.
On her association with Krishna.
On her association with Krishna.
Priya.
Priya.
By her beloved. Prastapitam.
Prastapitam.
Sent.
Dutam.
Dutam. A messenger.
A messenger.
Kalpayitva.
Kalpayitva.
Imagining it.
Imagining it.
Idam.
Idam.
The following. Aravit.
Aravit.
Spoke.
Spoke.
Translation and purport by the followers, the disciples of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada Gita Jaya. One of the gopis, while meditating on her previous association with Krishna, saw a honey bee before her and imagined it to be a messenger sent by her beloved. Thus she spoke as follows. I think this microphone needs to be turned down a smidgen. Purport. Srimati Radharani is referred to in this verse as Kachit, a certain gopi. To establish that this particular gopi is in fact Srimati Radharani, Srila Jiva Goswami quotes the following verses from the Agni Purana. Gopya pracha iju isasi krishna yucharam udhavam Hari lila vidaram scha tatra kam radikam vina radata bhava samlila vasanaya viramita sakibi sabhya chachuda vijnana guna drimbitam ijyante Vishinam Veda Charam Sa Vibhavanai. At dawn, the gopis inquired from Krishna's servant, Uddhava, about the Lord's pastimes and recreation. Only Srimati Radharani, immersed in thought of Krishna, withdrew her interest in the talks. And then Radha, who was worshipped by the residents of her Vrindavan village, spoke up in the midst of her girlfriends. Her words were full of pure transcendental knowledge and expressed the ultimate portion of the Vedas. In the Bhagavad Gita 15.15, Lord Krishna states, Vedaischa sarvir aham eva vedya. By all the Vedas I am to be known. To know Krishna is to love Krishna. And thus Radharani, by her own example and words, revealed her supreme love for the Lord. Having quoted the above verses from Agni Purana, Srila Jiva Goswami also quotes the following from the Nisimha Tapani Upanishad, Purva Kanda 2.4. Yam Save Deva Nimanti Pramukshavo Brahma Vedinas Cha. All the demigods and all the transcendental philosophers who desire liberation bow down to the Supreme Lord. We should follow suit. Translation again. One of the gopis, while meditating on her previous association with Krishna, saw a honeybee before her and imagined it to be a messenger sent by her beloved. Thus she spoke as follows. Om Jnanati Manandasya Gnanjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmilitam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpa Trubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyebhacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Garadha Sri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Kunda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. So this of course is a very confidential part of Bhagavatam, which I am grossly disqualified to speak on. We were expecting His Grace Prahladananda Swami to be here, but obviously his classes will begin tomorrow. So Krishna Guja, as an emergency measure, has asked me to sit here. So we will try and say something. So what is happening here? Uddhava has been sent by Krishna to Vrindavan for two reasons. The overtly expressed reason is that Krishna is thinking of his devotees in Vrindavan and thinking they must be suffering because of my absence. They are so attached to me and I'm not there anymore, and therefore they must be suffering incredible heartbreak in my absence. Therefore I want to send a letter to console them and to enlighten them with transcendental philosophy, so they understand actually there is no separation from me in any circumstance for my devotee. And secondly, the other reason is it's to take Uddhava to another level. Because Uddhava is a very intimate associate of Krishna. And he has a lot of devotion. He practically never leaves Krishna's side. He is Krishna's advisor. Krishna even takes advice from Uddhava. And Uddhava, when he's asked for advice, he goes, actually, Krishna, this is all just your pastime because you know everything. Why would you ask advice from me? But because it is your wish to play like this, I shall give my advice. And Uddhava is greatly exalted in his devotion and his position. But nevertheless, Krishna is saying, now you go to Vrindavan. Why? Because there you will see the devotion of the residents of Vrindavan, which is on another level altogether. So Uddhava has gone there, and he arrived in the morning, and on his golden chariot. Uddhava is very beautiful. He looks almost like Krishna. And as they do every day, the gopis, they went to see Mother Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj, who were crying incessantly due to their separation from Krishna. So they'd go every morning, and you know, the suffering residents would console one another and offer their respects. This is the mother and father of our beloved. And so they arrived there outside the house of Nanda and Yashoda, and then they saw a beautiful golden chariot, and they began to get a little bit agitated. They said, oh no, our Krura has returned. He's already broken our hearts by taking Krishna away from us. Now he's come again. How unfortunate, that rascal. Krura is actually, you know, some of the acharyas speculate that why was Krura involved in the controversy of the Shambhantaka jewel? You know, the who was it? Satrajit was killed. and Akura was involved in that controversy, and how could a devotee be entangled in such a scandalous affair? And the chariots say, actually, it's because he was cursed by the gopis. He was cursed by the gopis for taking Krishna away in their loving anger. So they were thinking, oh, Akura's come again. Anyway, our heart's already broken. What can he do to us now? We're just basically like dead bodies. And what's the use in flailing a dead body? Anyway, they found out that it was Uddhava. And Uddhava was very beautiful, looked almost like Krishna. And for the moment, they were stunned, like, oh, Krishna has come back. But then they realized that it was not actually Krishna. So Uddhava had come, and he'd seen the ecstatic devotion of Mother Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj. We were just talking incessantly of Krishna's childhood pastimes. And then occasionally they just become stunned and just cry incessant tears. And he was thinking, I don't have even a pinch of this devotion. This is very wonderful. And he actually said, you know, you are very exalted. He was humbled. And of course, as devotees, we always need the association of more advanced devotees. What does that mean, more advanced devotee? One whose meditation, loving meditation, is more intense and more developed than our own. You see, in this material world, we're trying to become devotees. That means our meditation is mixed. Sometimes we think about Krishna. You know, that's why we do our sadhana, to try and increase that, those thoughts of Krishna. But most of the time we think about different aspects of this material world and our endeavor to enjoy it, how that's going and how we can enhance that and optimize in many different fields. So our meditation is mixed. But a more advanced devotee, by dint of their purification, they have become detached from the material world to a larger degree, and therefore their meditation is more exclusive, if not completely exclusively, on the lotus feet of Krishna. And even those who are pure are always conscious of Krishna. There is different degrees of intensity. And the height of the height of intensity is displayed by the resonance of Vrindavan. Now, it's an interesting point that there is varieties of emotions, including anxiety, in the spiritual world. You see, frustrated with the spiritual world, sorry, the material world, and the problems of being a person, you know, becoming detached and then becoming attached and then having your heart broken due to not attaining your desired object, or attaining it but then becoming frustrated, or attaining it and then it withers and fades away. You know, having to deal with other people who are got their own agendas and trying to get along. You know, Nietzsche said of human civilization that it could be compared to like a society of porcupines. When you have porcupines, are very spiky. They have very spiky bodies, and it's very cold outside in the winter. So the porcupines, they think we must huddle together in order to protect ourselves from this material world. You know, protect ourselves from the terrible cold. So they huddle together, but of course they're all covered in spikes. So when they get close to one another, they spike each other. And eventually they give up and they say, well, there's no consolation here, and then they walk out into the cold to die. So of course Nietzsche was what's called a nihilist. He wasn't a very optimistic personality. But in some respects, this analogy is it can be applied to material society, where we're suffering loneliness. We know we're social creatures. We need to get together and try and console our hearts. But because everybody's got their own selfish agenda and full of so many impurities and anartas, we tend to, when we get together, hurt one another. And then some people, they get completely frustrated by this affair and decide solitude is the way. And Prabhupada explains that the spiritual conclusion of impersonalism, that it is all just one and eventually, and this, the whole manifestation of personality is a unfortunate illusion that has come upon us and that needs to be dispelled. That arises due to frustration with being a person in the material world. Prabhupada explains that. And even in the spiritual community, you know, you see that sometimes people get upset with one another. There are personality clashes, there are slights, there are offenses. But in the spiritual community, we must practice forgiveness. We must practice the charity of forgiveness. That we are all human beings with our foibles, our weaknesses, our shortcomings, our selfish agendas, which we try to overcome. That's the point we're trying to overcome. And, you know, we will hurt each other occasionally. But one should be charitable and let those things pass and see the best that this person is trying to become pure. And that should always be the social pressure. That there is forgiveness and sensitivity, but there is also a social momentum there encouraging a person to overcome the issues in an organic, gradual way. You know, I went down to Tasmania for 5 days. 7 days. We did some catering for a few days, and then I went with a few of us, a couple of guys, were cultivating in Krishna consciousness, and Glenn. We went for a little bit of a tour of Tasmania, you know, to refresh the mind, to see some nice scenery and so forth. And of course, you know, you're driving with people and you're cooking, you've got to do this, and sometimes, you know, a person will make a mistake and will go the wrong way in the car. I forgot to bring the pots. So many things happen, you know. Practically every, you know, 10 times a day somebody makes a mistake. And, you know, it's easy, you know, to, you know, when the mistake becomes apparent, you know, you need the pots. And then you remember, actually, yeah, it's my true yoga, forgot the pot. So we had to buy another pot, and it comes out of my pocket. And it's easy to bring that up again and say, yeah, good one, you forgot the pot. But what this creates is a grudging atmosphere. So this mood of forgiveness, letting things go. I make mistakes, you make mistakes. We are imperfect human beings. This needs to be done in order for us to become mature in the life of community, human community. Many people struggle with this. They think they must be perfect and everybody else must be perfect, otherwise they don't want anything to do with it. And then what they tend to do is isolate themselves a little bit. But that's not good for spiritual advancement. The best thing is we mature and learn to tolerate and get along. And by this, we become purified. And we develop experience, deep sangha with one another, which is very enlivening. And it's actually the catalyst for spiritual growth. Prabhupada said, you know, it's like river stone. It might be very dirty, and as the waters churn, the stones bang into one another. And that could be seen as an inconvenience. But also, by that same process, they become polished. So if we stay together, stick together, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I'm going to try my best to be in for the long haul, which means 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, whatever. So I hope to know some of you in that time, 50 years later. And we will have been through a lot of things at that point. And there should be a very deep sense of fellowship there. So that's one point. Another point, actually, that I picked up from the trip was on this idea of oneness. You know, we were climbing Cradle Mountain. Cradle Mountain is one of the most beautiful spots in Tasmania, and Tasmania is one of the most beautiful tracts of land in the world. So it's a very nice place. And we the first night we drove past Cradle Mountain. We wanted to camp there, but all the rangers were busting people camping illegally. And the all the campsites and the cabins were ridiculously expensive, and the campsites were all taken up. And so we couldn't camp there, but we got directed to this lake, so we camped by this nice, beautiful lake. And we saw Cradle Mountain as we were driving past, and that looks stunning. Apparently the explorer who first discovered the place, he walked over the ridge and saw the beautiful valley stretched out with Cradle Mountain there, all the alpine gum forests. And he said, "This place is wonderful." He said, "Oh, I must make it a national park and build roads so people can come here and experience the beauty of this place. This place is wonderful." He's German, I believe. And it is very nice. We saw that and we thought, wow, that's going to be cool the next day. So we went and camped by the river. We got up, we took our bath. It was early and we went up to the mountain. We were going to chant our japa at the mountain. But the day was overcast. Incredibly overcast. When you get up the alpine region, it's like, it had like visibility of like 150 meters. It was still nice, you know, we saw little, you know, marsupial paddy melons, which are like kangaroos cruising around and different things. It was very fresh and cool. So we decided to go for a walk anyway. Perhaps as the day wears on, the air will warm and the condensed clouds, you know, they'll elevate and will be granted a darshan of the landscape. So this was the intention. So we started walking. We took this. Me and David, we took the steep route, and Glenn and Dale, they took the long, less demanding route. And we went up, and we met at a point, and it was still very overcast. And at this point, you could have a visibility of about 50 meters. You know, you walk to the edge of a, you know, precipice, which is it's a lookout, you know, and all you see is white. You know, you can't see down, you can't see up, you can't see very far side to side. It's just white. Normally, these are like views to die for. You know, you're standing on top of a mountain, the landscape stretch out, you can see for hundreds of miles. You know, beautiful forest. And we were thinking, oh, this is wonderful. You can see for meters. I even joked with one guy when I was going back down. But the point is, you know, I was thinking this is just like the impersonalists. You know, they don't want to see the variety. You know, you can see the different forest and the sky and the different colors. And the variety in the image, in the view. Rather, they just want to see the oneness, the whiteness. I was thinking, you know, this isn't really practical because, you know, most people, they come up to see the view and they'd probably be grossly disappointed that they missed out and they just saw the oneness, you know, the Brahman effulgence, just like this, because, you know, the sun is shining through the cloud and it's kind of really bright and your eyes are like blasted with this whiteness. It's like the Brahman effulgence. But actually this was inferior to the variety of a fully manifest view which we were missing out on. So, yeah, there is variety in the transcendental world. We have rasas. The idea is that there is a supreme personality of Godhead, that the supreme source of everything is in fact the person, the most wonderful, complete person. Everything emanates from him, he is everything. Simultaneously different from that, behold my mystic opulence, he says. He is there, the supreme person. And the awakened souls, which is the majority, they live in relationship with that supreme Lord in different rasas, in different relationships. And there are five primary relationships. Servitude is the first one. Dasya. One sees the Lord as his superior. He is my master. It is my duty to serve humbly his lotus feet. Then we have Sakya, whose neutrality is. Sakya, which is friendship. The Lord is my equal. He's no big man. I'll climb on his shoulders. Friendship is the experience between equals. In the material world, when you have somebody who's your equal intelligence, equal age, equal strength, you tend to develop what's called a friendship. You know, you joke with each other, you poke one another in the ribs, you experience life together and you feel a sort of a mutual companionship, fellowship. That's friendship, Sakya. Then we have Vatsalya, the parental affection. I am actually the protector, the maintainer of the Lord. We also experience this in the material world when we get to a certain age and we get married or whatever, and we procreate, and the offspring, the products, become our children, which we nurture and care for, and we develop this parental affection that I am looking after these people. A teacher might also feel that for his students. Anybody in a kind of a superior minding, looking after, caring relationship might experience some semblance of Vatsalya Ras. And then of course you have Madhurya Ras, that I am the Lord's lover. The Lord is my lover. There is a sense of equality there. There is a deep friendship and companionship there. But there's also an extra flavor of romantic enchantment. So these are the rasas. There's also neutrality, which if we rewind and put that at the beginning. That, you know, that's a controversy whether that's actually a true rasa or not. So these rasas are there, these primary rasas, and then they are spiced with various sub-rasas. And this creates a whole landscape of experience, emotional experience. One's devotional sentiments flood out in a certain mood, in a certain rasa, and then they're reciprocated. And within that experience of relationship, there's so many different day-to-day flavors coming and going. Sometimes humor, sometimes anger, sometimes joking, you know, sometimes serious consideration. Lots of different flavors rising and falling within this backdrop of the primary rasa. So in Vrindavan, these rasas were most pronounced. They were there purely. The residents of Vrindavan, they didn't even know that Krishna was God. They don't know that. By Krishna's grace, they don't know that. They forgot it. Mother Yashoda, she was minding Krishna, Balarama and their friends. And Krishna, the other children, they came, they were a bit annoyed with Krishna. Perhaps he was winning the game, or he was cheating, or something like that. And they came and they said, Mother Yashoda, your son Krishna, he has been eating dirt. He is a rascal. Therefore you should chastise him. And Krishna said, no, this is a false accusation. I have not been eating dirt. They are just envious. If you want to check for sure, you look in my mouth, please. Mother Yashoda said, sounds like a fair proposal. Based on the evidence, I'll prosecute or not. So Krishna opened his mouth and Mother Yashoda looked in. And lo and behold, the complete cosmic situation was manifest before her, including herself. Very bewildering sight. And she began to become completely bewildered. And then she began to pray. She began to wonder, actually, what is the cause of this? Am I sick? No, I'm in good health. Are the demigods bewildering me? No, I'm just an insignificant woman of this material world. Why would they bother to bewilder me? I'm not really a significant feature of their business. And in various ways, she tried to reason as to the cause. And then she said, actually, this must be the illusory energy. This was the conclusion. Must be the illusory energy of Vishnu. And then she began to pray. O Vishnu, you are supreme. I am sorry that I think that Nanda Maharaj is my husband, that Krishna is my son, that the cowherd men and women of Vrindavan are my subjects. This is all your illusory energy, putting me into ignorance. I am sorry. And then Krishna said, anyway, enough of this. I want to get back to our rasa. So he covered her consciousness, and then Mother Yashoda looked at Krishna and said, oh, my boy. Immediately went back under the influence of Vishnu Maya and proceeded to embrace Krishna very lovingly. So by Krishna's grace, and Krishna didn't want this remembrance that, oh, Krishna is the Lord. He didn't want that consciousness because that would disturb the rasa, the intensity of flavor. So he covered them. And that's the same with all the residents of Vrindavan. Now, chief among the residents of Vrindavan were the gopis. And the gopis, more than anyone else, they had a problem. What was their problem? We love Krishna, but Krishna's not here. This is a problem. We have great affection for Krishna, but the object of our affection is absent. And all we've got are these remembrances which make our heart burn day and night. Sometimes we're trying to do activities and then our memory crosses our mind and we become stunned and we can't do anything. We just cry. And it's so frustrating, you know, because you try and reconcile the whole thing in your mind, but because you're so intensely attached, it's just a circle that goes round and round and round and round and round. And because you're just thinking about Krishna, how to become detached from Krishna, but Krishna did this and Krishna did that, and he's a rascal, but we love him so much, and it just goes round and round and round. And it's an entangling meditation. One just becomes more and more absorbed in this whirlpool of remembrance of Krishna, which is spiced with intense love. So the gopis, they had a problem. And Krishna was sympathetic. So I had sent Uddhava. And Uddhava was sitting. And the gopis, you know, Uddhava especially wanted to see the gopis. And the gopis were especially interested to see Uddhava. So once Uddhava was a little bit indisposed, they said, come with us, you know. And they went to a quiet place in the forest. And they said, tell us about Krishna. What is he doing? And at this point, this verse arises. One of the gopis, while meditating on her previous association with Krishna, saw a honeybee before her and imagined it to be a messenger sent by her beloved. Thus she spoke as follows. So this, of course, is that gopi who has the supreme love for Krishna, Srimati Radharani. She's just hearing the talks about Krishna, just became overwhelmed with remembrance of Krishna and just sort of fell back out of the conversation and entranced by her memories. And then before her appeared a bumblebee and started buzzing here and there. And in Nectar of Devotion, these talks are given as an example of the madness of love of God. It's a bumblebee. Bumblebee is a dumb creature. All it is doing is going, there's some flower to get some pollen, you know, because that's my instinctual programming. It's not thinking anything particularly profound. But Radharani says, oh, this bumblebee is black like Krishna. oh, it's probably a messenger from Krishna. And therefore, and thus she began to speak to the bumblebee. And immediately, and because love of God is not just one thing, it's many things. So for Radharani, it was like the love that a lover or a woman feels for her lover very intensely. It goes in waves. Sometimes anger arises. You know, you don't give me enough attention. And the kind of anger there, but then that subsides, and oh, I'm just so attached. So, yeah. This was Radharani's experience. Initially, she was angry. She said, "Why? Krishna has left us. I want nothing to do with him. You stupid messenger, go away. You know, Krishna, I know he's in the big city now and he's enjoying the association of all the society girls. He doesn't care about us, so therefore, why should we give a damn about him? Krishna can go off and do whatever he wants. We don't care. That's all right." And then she told Krishna, "I'm not coming to see him. You want to care? You can't care." And then she said, "I see. Krishna has brought you here to carry me there. I'm not going to go. I'm not going to go to gratify that womanizer. And anyway, how could I go? You're just a bumblebee. You know, you couldn't carry me." And then the bumblebee disappeared. And then Radharani was like, "Oh no, perhaps the bumblebee's taken my message of anger back to Krishna, and Krishna will be hurt and pained by that. Oh no!" And she began to lament intensely. And then the bumblebee returned, you know, gone behind a bush or something, and came out again. I said, "Oh, bumblebee, you are very exalted messenger of Krishna." "Yes, yes. I didn't actually mean those things. Actually, Krishna is very wonderful. And tell me about his activities in the city. I just wanted to hear about those. And forget about all these talks of me going there or him coming there. That's beside the point, you know. Just tell me about his activities, because they're so wonderful. And please take my love to him." So he went through many different she went through many different flavors in this internal dialogue. Actually, it was an internal dialogue, but it anthropomorphized this bumblebee as a messenger of Krishna. And for our benefit, should verbalize them all, so we could understand the intense meditation that was happening within her. Now, Krishna, what did he do? He sent a letter, a very philosophical letter. Now, generally when somebody's upset, especially a woman, she doesn't want a lot of philosophy. "Now, you shouldn't be upset because of this, 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 and this. That's irrational. You're in an irrational state. That's not the way to deal with it, according to all the books." No, the way is like, "Oh, really, you feel like that?" Empathy. "Oh, I'm so sorry you feel like that. Oh, I'm feeling it too." Then there's a sense of gratification there. Somebody understands my state. No, but Krishna just sent this very philosophical letter. "You should know that I am the Supreme Lord of Love." But anyway, this letter, because it's from Krishna, was supremely enlightening. And what was Krishna's main thesis in his letter? "I am the Supreme Lord. All energy is mine. Your remembrance of me is non-different from my presence." You see, normally in this material world, the thought of something is different from the thing. That's why many times, you know, somebody can give you you have daily association with, can give you a dirty look or something. And you think, "Oh, they must be angry with me." And that's probably because of that thing. And then you put this whole fantasy together in your head. That's right, they're feeling like this and they think of me like that, and therefore I'm angry about this. And you can build this whole elaborate fantasy. They're conspiring against me, you know. But actually, they got a prickle in their foot, and they just stood on that sensitive foot that drove the prickle a little bit deeper. It's like, "Oh." But you took it personally. That happens all the time. You see something and you create some idea But that idea is not accurate. A Buddhist poet once wrote, you know, mind has more projections than the dust nodes of the sun. Where is that yogi who can perceive things as they are? In other words, the mind is an intense labyrinth of misconception. Where is the person who can actually get beyond this misconception, which arises from actually attachment, personal agendas? The mechanics of perception are that sensory stimulus comes in to us. It is then filtered through the mind with its many layers of existential conceptions, emotional attachments, so many different things. And what the image that's finally presented to the consciousness is slanted, just like contemporary reporters will slant things. You know, when you read the media and stuff, it's slanted. There's a certain angle put on it, a spin. So this is the nature of our perception as well. Therefore, we should take all our mental conceptions with a grain of salt. Especially if one's a manager, the best thing is to get all the facts very clear before you make any decisions, especially if it's a people-based decision. What is your feelings? What are your feelings? And then you put the whole thing together clearly, and then, so that's the actual situation. Because somebody, you talk to somebody and they'll say, yeah, this person did that, and that's, therefore they're a rascal, and therefore I'm justified in my feeling. And then you talk to the other person, they've got a different view, and theirs is also, you've got some good points, and you realize this is an interpersonal feud, and then you're able to make a clear decision. So we should take our mental conceptions with a grain of salt. But, and also the thing is, we tend, if we become very attached to something and then we have separation, we have a remembrance of it. And that remembrance might be very intense. Even in the beginnings of romantic enchantment, there'll be a small interaction will play in the mind of the lover, and there'll be a huge big fantasy built around that, and they'll develop a whole concept of the person they're involved with, and that concept is often, very often, completely different from the actual fact. And that's what happens after a few years. They go, hang on, you're not the person I married. In other words, you're not my initial idealistic mental conception. Therefore, a poet once wrote, it is not you I love, but the idea of you. So, this sense of separation, that causes us pain. The object of my love is not here. But Krishna said, actually, I am everything. I am also your thoughts. I am also my holy name. So when you think of me, I am present in those thoughts. You are close to me when you think of me. It's okay, you can make a deity within your mind and worship that deity. That is alright. That's the nature of consciousness. Consciousness is experiencing the field, which is both gross and subtle. And from an absolute point of view, there is nothing more real about the gross field than the subtle field. The consciousness is more subtle still. What they do ultimately is constitute different sensations passing over the consciousness, whether they be emotions and thoughts or physical sensations. This is simply what is going on, is the knower is there and the field is there. And the field is gross and subtle. And Krishna is that field. So when one is fully absorbed in God consciousness, remembering Krishna, Krishna is that remembrance. You can worship that remembrance, and that is devotional service. So this is Krishna's philosophy. And actually said, as he said to the gopis, actually I left you simply to intensify what was already intense. And I could not repay your devotional sentiments. They were so perfect and selfless. The only thing I could do to reward you was to leave you, to take you to that next level of intensity. In my absence, you would think about me with greater fervor. This is your reward. So Krishna explained all these things, and then the gopis felt a bit better. So we are followers of Lord Chaitanya in the Gaudiya Vaishnav Sampradaya. And what was Lord Chaitanya doing in the final pastimes? Adi Leela, we read about, he was in the cell, you know, because he'd run away and run all sorts of things. They were pretty worried about him, so they'd lock him in a room and lock all the doors at night. And Lord Chaitanya would simply be in that cell, absorbed in internal consciousness, unaware of the external environment. And in his remembrance, he'd rub his face on the wall. And in the morning, Swarup Damodar and the other associates, they would come in and they'd be greatly disturbed because the Lord's face was all covered in cuts due to his intense anxiety he was experiencing. You know, he'd see Govardhan, he'd see a sand dune on the beach and start running towards it. And I had to think, this is Govardhan Hill. He's blurring the boundaries between what was actually present and his internal remembrance. He was experiencing this love and separation. This is what he came to give, his highest rasa. And we are following the six Goswamis whose mission was never fulfilled. Devamrita Swami is always making this point. How do you feel? You're following your acharyas. You're following them, but their mission was never fulfilled. You're much less than them, so how will your mission ever be fulfilled? Therefore, you're on an eternally frustrated quest to attain Krishna. But you'll always be separated. That's the idea. How do you feel about that? You going to carry on? But of course, this hankering, this where is Krishna, this intense meditation displayed by Lord Chaitanya and his followers is the paramount expression of love for God. Always hankering for Krishna. One final point, there's a quote. Krishnagarjuna knows it, knows the specifics of it, but Prabhupada once said to a certain fellow, I think, who frequents this place, purchase anxiety for Krishna at any cost. Mm-hmm. Was that, who was it? It was Sanghanath. What a statement. Purchase anxiety for Krishna at any cost. You know, many people think the idea of spiritual life is that now I'm detached, I can just relax. I can be peaceful, finally. What is the Krishna conscious teaching? No, now I've voluntarily taken on anxiety. You've given up the false anxiety, now take on spiritual anxiety. And sometimes it's like that, you know, we take on a big responsibility or something, it's resting on our shoulders, we can't stop, it becomes an anxiety. If we stop, the thing won't happen. Like I experienced that when doing renovations and so forth. You start something, you make a huge mess. You do some destruction, you know. Start pulling things down. And then you realize, hang on, I've just started and I can't go back now. And then the sense of anxiety comes over. Oh, what have you done? Now you've got like hours and hours of hard work ahead of you to try and get it back. And you're on a deadline. And it's just like, it's intense. But then you think, actually, this is nectar. Because now I get to feel intense anxiety for Krishna's service. So we should do that. We should not be afraid of anxiety for Krishna. Yeah, one final point. When I was in Sydney Temple, I was living there for a few months. And at that point, I was just coming to Krishna consciousness. I'd come from New Zealand and I went traveling and I stayed in the Sydney Temple for a few months. And one day I was doing meditation and yoga and stuff, and I was very peaceful. I was experiencing Shanti. I was chanting a bit of Hare Krishna. And the temple president came in, and he said to me, "Tim, what are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I've just done some yoga and meditation, and now I'm feeling very peaceful, and I'm resounding the holy name." He said, "This is nonsense." He said, "While you're sitting there blissing out, 100 people just walk past on their way to hell. What are you doing about that?" You've got misconceptions about spiritual life. And that always struck me. Very nice teaching. We should purchase anxiety for Krishna at any cost. We should have this. We should have Lord Chaitanya's anxiety. What is his anxiety? That the tree of love of God is producing so many fruits. And Lord Chaitanya is thinking, how can I distribute all these fruits? There are so many. I think if I am the only distributor, some may get them and some may not. And that would not be good. Everybody should drown in this flood of love of God. Therefore, as devotees of Lord Chaitanya, we should take his anxiety as our own and try and relieve it. We should take up the mission of Lord Chaitanya to distribute love of God, whatever our means, with great fervor, with anxiety. We should feel pain when we see people suffer and destroying themselves. This is real compassion, and this is the true fuel for outreach. Alright, thank you so much for listening attentively. Is there any questions or comments on these points? Yes, sir.
One comment. This is like mono-acting in the modern world. Mono-acting.
Yeah.
Only one person expressing their emotions and feelings and the hatred and whatever. So, Mahaprabhu emotions, Gopi, but and the. So do you want to express how you express the sentiment?
You mean be a servant of the servant of the servant?
Yeah.
And you're saying mono acting. The material world is mono acting.
Yeah. Like in a play.
Mono.
Yeah.
I mean like one.
Only one actor.
One actor.
Yes.
Right. If I understand the point, you're saying that the material existence is very much about the individual. Who is that individual? Me! And everything else is structured around that. You have a relationship because it gives me a certain flavor. You do a thing because it's me. Even if you do charity, you do that because it gives me a certain feeling. And it's very selfish, right? I am the center of my works. And you're saying, well, Chaitanya's philosophy is that no, we should be a servant. Yeah, well, the idea is that we cannot gratify ourselves directly. The devotee is watching Krishna's face and doing some service, and when Krishna smiles, pleased with the service, that happiness is the devotee's as well. He's not concerned with his own smile or happiness. When Krishna smiles, then the happiness becomes his. And it's the same in the devotional community. We should enjoy serving the devotees. And you think about it, it's good in mathematics. You know, I'm one person serving me, so then I've got one servant. But if I don't worry about my own service, I just serve everyone else. Say I'm in a community of 10 people. Then I'm serving 10 people, but I've also got 10 servants. So that's better math.
That means service with extreme humility.
With humility, yeah. Yeah, there should be that faith that if I simply serve devotees, if I simply serve Krishna, then my needs will be taken care of. And Devamrita Swami makes a very important point that is very deep and should be meditated upon. And that is that many times devotees, you know, they go along for a few years in Krishna consciousness and they think, you know, I have my Krishna conscious practice, but then I need other things in my life to fulfill different aspects of my emotional being. you know, to challenge me intellectually, to do this, to do that. And he says, but it's a very profound realization when one understands that simply by outreach, by taking anxiety for people on your shoulders, by considering how to spread Lord Chaitanya's mission, by meeting people, by having social interactions, and trying to encourage people in Krishna consciousness, by being a preacher, one's emotional life can be completely fulfilled. By being a servant of the devotees and by being a servant of the people. That's what Gurudev's last instruction was to me. He said, be a humble servant of the devotees and the people. He said, by doing this, one can be completely fulfilled. That's an art, how to do it nicely, how to relate to the devotees and the people properly, and to have the right meditation there. If one can do that, then one can be completely fulfilled. And one will not need to look elsewhere for satiation, because that's basically the condition, human condition, is we're looking for fulfillment in so many places in a mistaken way, and therefore we create more problems and our struggle. And the Krishna conscious understanding is that, yeah, fulfillment is found in the role of the servant. Did that help? Is that correct answer? Anybody else? Yes, Madhavi? Our relationship with Krishna is expressed through our service. I don't think you mean anxiety like, you know, you've got a very emotional, rational person who's kind of like, you know, just strung out. You know, so every little thing is like, oh! A devotee should not be in passion and ignorance. But one should, I guess it's like, the point I was speaking to Gopal Guru yesterday, you know, about catering. Now, Gopal Guru, you see his service, he's very dedicated. If he sees another catering gig, then he can fit in. He's already got an intense schedule. He's a busy man. He's got an intense schedule. If he finds another catering gig that he can just jam in somewhere, he'll go, he'll take that, and he'll jam it in. You know, stretch himself. Okay? He'll take it to another level. Simply why? Because he's thinking, this is good for the temple, this is good for preaching. This brings in money, and this distributes prasadam to the people. Therefore, I'm willing to sacrifice my own comfort. I could just relax and, you know, sit at home, my wife will cook me nice prasadam, and have a rest from all the other work I've been doing. But no, no, he says, no, no, no. Forget my comfort. You know, what is best for Krishna's service? So then he takes on that extra sort of struggle, that extra austerity. And that is actually the greatest shelter. You know, to be... Prabhupada said, you know, Krishna consciousness should always be a great challenge. Because if it's not challenging, if we're not challenging ourselves, we get bored. And as soon as we get bored, we get distracted by Maya. So I think that's, you've got to have a certain intensity there. Be proactive, you know. Not just like, whatever service comes to me, I'll do that, you know. And when it's finished, then I'll relax. No, it should be like this eagerness to go out there and find service. And to do that service with an attachment. I am attached to the success of this temple. I am attached to the success of the Krishna consciousness movement. Yeah, and I am pained to see the suffering of the conditioned souls. Therefore, let me take anxiety upon myself, austerity. Let me stretch myself. Let me disregard my own comfort. I'm not going to worry about what I eat or wear. I'm just going to surrender to the Lord everywhere. He is both within and without. You can know without a doubt by chanting the holy name. Yeah, so I will stretch myself to further the goals of Srila Prabhupada, to further the mission of Lord Chaitanya. I will stretch. Yeah, I think that's what it means. Yeah. Anybody else? Points? Thank you so much. Kontraj Srinath Bhagavatam ki.
Yeah.